So the Gemara Megillah, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, points out the famous statement you find in many different chazals. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, it's in Megillah 28a, as well as other places, Mikra, Mishnah, Talmud, Vagada, Afilu Masha Talmud Vasik. Any question any students might ask you during this year, Asid L'chadesh, or as the Gra has a different word, Asid L'horos, this Tapaskin, but the key is Kfar Nemar L'moshe Misinai. Everything already was given. There's nothing new under the sun, so to speak. It was all given to Moshe Har Sinai. So, what exactly does this mean? So,
Mikra, what are the four?
Mikra, Mishnah, Talmud, and Agada.
What do you mean Talmud and Agada?
One could be, Agada could be more the Medrashim, the story,
it's different types of Talmud.
Right, I'm saying.
Okay, fine.
That's a separate chair.
Yeah, right, I understand.
So, Rev Hirsch and Rashi, not necessarily in that order, have seemed to learn the much more narrow approach, and the Rambam, he doesn't mention Rashi by name, but in his Hakdama to the Gemara, he trashes that opinion. He quotes, some people think that what it means is every din, every single detail was given to Moshe Har Sinai, and the only job left for us is to transmit over what was given. So God gave Moshe everything, and I guess all the machlokism, I guess, are just based on forgetting on anything that wasn't such a good transmission or something like that. They take a much more literal approach. That's it. Everything was given. Nothing. It's a big job in its own right, transmission. But it's nothing. We don't have to make up. We don't have to take principles and apply them. However, we assume, meaning the Rambam and the majority opinion is, we assume that you just put in one word that every potential, l'pekoach, in other words, all the principles were taught to Moshe at Har Sinai. However, the application of those principles are left for each and every future generation.
Yeah. Who said this latter point of view? Is this Rashi?
It's the one right now is the Rambam.
Oh, this is the Rambam you're talking
right,
about.
Right, Rambam and the consensus.
The more literal thing seems to be Rashi and
Rav Shimshul for Hirsch, right, I think one of his essays.
Oh, he goes in the Midrash about
right, so that's how they try to prove to back up the Rambam's chat seems to be like the Gemara Menachas, with as Mike pointed out in Menachas Chavtes, that what does the Gemara say? The famous story where Moshe was up in the heavens with God, and God took him on a nice tour, and he took him to. He said, "Hey, I have a good share for you, Moshe. I think you'd appreciate this one." And like usually what happens in most cases, you just sit there, don't know what's going on. Or you sit there, he goes in, and Rabbi Akiva is really darshing all over the place, and Moshe starts feeling bad. He says, "What is that? I thought this is my Torah. What's going on here? What's this guy talking about?" Until at the end, he heard during the shiur, he said, "And how do you know this?" They asked Rabbi Akiva. He says, "Halacha l'Moshe mi-Sinai. These are laws that were taught to Moshe on our Sinai." And Moshe felt a little better after that. So the Kasha is like, what do you mean? How could Moshe not know what his own Torah? Does it mean like he forgot what 1 + 1 is? So the Mefarshim point out, no, wasn't it Rabbi Akiva and all the preceding generations took Moshe Rabbeinu's principle to Har Sinai, and every generation developed it further and further. Like you take a certain, however it is to build a bridge, whatever, you take certain sciences, you work on an invent with modern technology, you take someone's principle from hundreds of years ago, and you developed a phone, computer, whatever you're doing. So that's what happened here, is the principle was there, but they expanded on the principle, they went into it further, and they came out. So therefore Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what was going on, even though it was his own principle. Others want to say, what does Rashi do with this Gemara? Let's say, how would Hirsch answer this Gemara? It seems to be a proof against them. So, no money could just say the Gemara is a goddess, huh? And what's the difference? But also, some want to bring a proof. What is it? It's Ola Lamarum. When did this happen? Someone, like Rashi, would claim is before Matan Torah. Before he taught him all the Torah, he took him up to the Lashon. You have to look at the Lashon HaGemara. Rashi writes something about Ola Lamarum. Like he took him up. He's like before. That's why Moshe didn't know what was going on. And then he went ahead and taught him the Torah. So either way, but that's the two schools of thought. The one most accepted, I would say, is the Rambam's opinion. Again, it's not a halacha or maaser question, it's just a matter of how you learn it, is that the principles were given to Moshe at Har Sinai, and it's for each generation, with based in the Sanhedrin, to come along and darshan the way they see fit. In fact, we find it throughout the Gemaras, we find how they did different services in the temple, I think with the Nisach HaYayin, with the pouring, with the wine libations, during the first temple and second, they were totally different. And they say because they darshan, they learned the psukim one way, and they did it one way, and the other based in later on, darshan psukim. So we find many Gemaras like that, that seem to be that not it's not what we call precedent, that something once based in Paskins one way, that's it. We don't necessarily believe in precedent per se, as precedent, you know, well, let's find precedent. You know, precedent could be a starting point, but it doesn't make a difference, precedent. If the later generation comes along and taking the Yud Gimel Midos, those 13 principles, and they learn it differently, so they're not Meshuba, but they don't have to keep to the original base then. There's no law like that. You know, today, when we get to today, it's a separate story. Well, today we don't have the same flexibility anymore. We'll get to why shortly.
From what you said then, is it a principle then that there is, first of all, the question of truth being self-evident, if Moses was thoroughly acquainted with everything he had given over, as soon as he heard an application of it, why did it not just become so self-evident to him? He said, of course I thought that.
Because it could have been many steps removed, right? I mean, infinite number of...
You sort of think once you get to the other side, you sort of have the ability to skip gradients so quickly that you could just go, oh yeah, I know where I get that from.
When you get to the other side, meaning if
well,
he's in heaven?
Assuming he's after death, yeah. But that,
okay,
so that's one
good. Got a good question. Why didn't Moshe say, you mean he's bright, you know, he wasn't one of the dummies, Moshe, he'd say, yes, of course, that follows him from my...
No, but it's like saying, what do you mean, he's saying someone who came, I don't know, whatever, whoever knows, let's say someone came up with some architect to this, and then he looks at something 1,000 years later, he's not going to say, oh wow, that's from me. In other words,
you mean
he can't...
Look at what the word computer means. That's another...
No, I don't care what the word computer means. No, not that the name is. I'm saying it's it looks totally different than his own creation. I'm saying, let's say, the person, you know, made the phone then, I don't know, he might see something now and not know what it is.
No, I don't... Modem is, for example. The person who invented the phone isn't going to understand the whole concept of a modem, right?
Right, okay.
Even though it's using a telephone line and...
Yeah, okay. But, so the other principle then that you're giving from this is that even though things are, it seems like when you're studying Gemara, you always have somebody contradicting somebody else.
Right. The point.
Nobody can contradict Moses then.
No. Right. Well, that's true. You can't contradict Moshe. So, because who else? Because no one knows that. You know, no one knows the Torah better.
Right. So then, anything that was given by Rabbi Akiva.
That's what we'll get to. It depends what. As I'm saying, if it's a Yud Gimel, that's the different levels of oral law. You're right. That's something which is Halach Lo Moshe Misinai is undisputable. The Rambam says there can't be a dispute on that. Even though the problem is, if different Gemaras, it seems to appear like a machlokas, but that needs explanation. But the principle is, anything which is halacha Moshe Misinai isn't, you can't, different generations can't dispute that point. It's only something where you take the 13 principles, and maybe some other principles, and you apply it, and then you can have a discussion among the Basins. But someone said, it's halacha Moshe Misinai, you can't say, okay, I know better than Moshe. You know, I'm more, right. So the point, this isn't a God, it's a Gemara, so no one knows exactly what's up in heaven. The point of the Gemara is that even the Rabbi Akiva took Moshe Rabbeinu's principles and applied it so much that even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't even know, you know, maybe after he thought about it, oh, you're right, he told him the principle, and of course he knew it. I'm not saying like he didn't know what was going on, but the point being is that even though it's clear that Rabbi Akiva was saying stuff over that Moshe wasn't even sure was his own until Rabbi Akiva told them, oh, well, it's based on this principle. So I'm just saying, the point being is that if every word was said over, it's just to contrast the other explanation. If every word was given over, then how could you even have a story like this, that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what was being said? If all you're doing is transmission, so I know what I said, we're assuming Moshe didn't forget one of his laws he gave over, so then like, what do you mean he didn't know? It must mean that obviously his principle is there.
Yeah. But when we talk about the afterlife, don't we always talk about the righteous man really wants to go to the great.
Right, but I'm not sure this Gemara is talking about the afterlife anyway.
Oh, okay, but just clear. Closing it. Right. We go to the great yeshiva in the sky. So the question would be, does Moses get to keep up with the current developments?
I mean, it's not so. In fact, I could bring a raya against that. That because there's a Gemara in many places. We have a principle called teiku, which itself is a disputed concept. But teiku, after the Gemara goes to a difficult topic, or maybe not so difficult topic, but they have a hard time concluding who's right. There's a machlokas in the Gemara between whoever, and certain, usually the Gemara comes to a conclusion. Other times they say teiku, which many say it stands for teiku, stands for tishbi, Eliyahu Navi, yitareit kushiyos v'abayas. Eliyahu HaNavi will come and answer up all these questions and answers we didn't have. Meaning when Mashiach comes, Eliyahu is going to be there to answer up all our questions. See, the Beis HaLevi does says, he thinks it's ridiculous that that's not what it means. He says it's just some cheder kid teachers teaching their students, you know, to remember the Mashiach. He thinks it means in the word tick, it's like a suitcase and these questions will be put away and they'll be answered later. But putting the Beis HaLevi aside and others, they're... But that's what people assume it to mean, that Eliyahu HaNavi is going to come and answer all our questions, right? So the question is, why Eliyahu? What happened to Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu can't answer our questions? Who knows the Torah? Why am I asking Torah's Moshe to Eliyahu? Let me go to the top gun here. Let's go to Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Kedusha Salevi, the Braditch of a Rebbe, he says, what's the pshat? He says, because we have a principle that Pinchas Zu Eliyahu, as I touched on for a second yesterday, Pinchas is Eliyahu, and Eliyahu never died. Pinchas never died. So right now Eliyahu is with us now. We don't see him. We don't know exactly. Whatever that means exactly, it's more than just, we have a general principle, Tzaddikim never die. Righteous people live on, but we don't mean physically speaking. We mean they die, but you learn the Rambam, so he's alive now. But Eliyahu is in a different stage. Whatever it means, he's, you know, we don't actually physically see him, but he comes to our Seder, he comes to our Bris, whatever it means exactly, but he's a higher stage of living. So they say, because what's happened? Let's say Moshe Rabbeinu has been dead for thousands of years. So when you pass in a Shaila, you have to know, obviously, all the principles. You got to be a big Talmud Chacham, you got to know all the principles. And then you also have to know how to apply the principles. So therefore, it says, Moshe Rabbeinu has been dead for 2,000 years, whatever it's been. So how you can't just wake up now and start passing shilas? You have to know the reality. You have to know you have to know how technology works. You have to know whatever. You have to know how to apply the halacha. Like they say, I think there's a rush in Baba Kama that says it's in a machlok. This is the Gemara. The Gemara says in a machlok is between Rav and Shmuel. So when it comes to Issa v'Heter, when it comes to shilas of whether a chicken is kosher or treif, or what's the law in Hilchas Avelis. So we pass in like Rav. He was the bigger Talmud Chacham. And Shmuel was also a Talmud Chacham in his own right, but he was also a doctor, they say, and other things. In the cases of Dini Mamonos, we pass in like Shmuel. So I haven't found this rush, but someone told me there's a rush that says, what's the reason? Actually, I heard it on a tape. I still haven't found the rush. But the guy has enough credibility. I believe the rush is somewhere. So he says, the rush says like this, what's the reason? Why when it comes to whether a chicken is kosher or a treif, that we go by Rav, but when it's a dine mamon, it's a civil matter, an issue between people, we go with Shmuel, because he says, when it came to this, who is a bigger Talmud Chacham? It's the same chicken, it's the same cow, it's a question on a cow, you go to the biggest Talmud Chacham. He could be sitting in his basement, not leaving it for 10 years, it's not going to change. In other words, there's a neck that doesn't change. But dine mamon, especially you're going down to, what's considered the business? Shaking a hand, a kinyan, or you have to know how the world works to paskin dine mamono shaila. You have to know, is shaking a hand a valid kinyan? What's the normal way of society? Because it's not that halacha changed with society. Halacha has principles, and based on how society works, you know what? So that's why we paskin like Shmuel in cases of dine mamonos. And he went on to explain a lot of it. He wants to say it's Rav and Shmuel with Shitaso, and in many disputes, like one we had on Pesach, in the Seder, that what the Gemara also tells us, you begin the Seder with, we talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. So it says we begin with disgrace of the Jewish people and end with the freedom. So it's a machlok is Rav and Shmuel, what exactly does the beginning of disgrace mean? So there are two opinions. So Rav says, Mitzchilas Ovdei Avodah Zarah, we have to talk about our ancestors who are idol worshippers. That's a disgrace to the Jewish people. And Shmuel was Avadim Hayinu. Shmuel says the disgrace is we were slaves in Egypt and now we went free. So he points out it's consistent with David. The Rav, who's the pure Torah, takes the pure, you know, forget about the physical world. What's the biggest disgrace for a Jew is worshipping idols. Torah is the ultimate, and the disgrace is that you're idols. But for, you know, a person who lives in the real world, per se, you know, not the Triash Rav, but this, what they call the real world is really Rav's world, but people who live in the so-called real world, is they say, you know, oh, a guy can't make a living, he's an eved, he's a slave, that's the worst disgrace of a man, he can't even make his own parnasa. So, it's Rav and Shmuel working within the, you know, and I think he gets a couple of other examples where, I think there's a Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara.
Who gives his examples, you say, who goes through the Rav and Shmuel?
I heard from Rabbi Bernstein, this Rav in England.
Yes.
He gave different examples.
Oh,
he gave a couple. I don't know if he said them all at one time. I heard them at different times, or maybe I read it some. I'm not sure if they're all from him, but I remember. Okay. I think he said them. I might have read them. Other Kedushas Halevi, I saw also. I saw it in another sefer I have. So I don't remember who I heard it first from or saw it first from. And then another example I'd say would be is that when Avram was going out to fight the war, so he had to get people. I think it was the war against to get Lopat. So it says, I forgot the exact lashon in the pasuk, but there's a machlokes that he rewarded the men, I think, or gave the money. So Rav says he rewarded them with, I think, tefillah, Torah, something spiritual. I remember the exact reward. And Shmuel says he gave him mammon, he gave him money. So either way, but getting back to here is, that's the point, is that the Kedushas HaLevi writes, the Levi B'Marditchev, that it's teiko. Why is it Moshe Rabbeinu? Because if Moshe Rabbeinu has been dead, so you can't just wake up and stop asking shaylos in a vacuum. Yeah, obviously, a prerequisite, you have to be a Talmud Chacham. But being a Talmud Chacham by itself, this isn't enough. As a Sanhedrin, you have to know that, you know, when the Gemara talks about Sanhedrin, has to know all these different things about, you know, and you have to know how the world works in order for it to pass in a shaylos. You can't just wake up and then, you know, if it's a chicken shaylos, then it doesn't make a difference where you are. But if it's a question of, you know, how people deal, civil matters, monetary issues, so every system works differently. You have to know how the system works, and then apply the principles of halacha to the system. So that's how he explains, that's why we ask Eliyahu HaNavi for the question, because he's been around and he knows exactly what's going on in the world.
Even kashrus of chickens, you know, it is a saying of somebody, I can't remember, was it the Gra, you know, you can't decide if the chicken is kosher until you look into the widow's eyes. I can't remember the exact.
Yes, Rav Chaim, either no de Behuda might have been.
I'm sorry,
or Rav Chaim.
No,
right,
so,
no, so right. There, so I'm just giving examples. So one.
Whose eyes? The widow
who's
bringing the chicken.
Right, there's a famous story. The question exactly what that means exactly.
And okay.
No, right. No, it's what is. I don't. I'm familiar with the kasha. What does that mean? Yes. You know, I'm saying.
I thought you said the chicken's eyes.
Maybe that also.
That also. It's before you slaughter the chicken, maybe after you slaughter the chicken, look in his eyes. But
the poor chicken.
But that's in the Kuda here is that by Moshe Rabbeinu, which you could take the he's been dead now, so therefore his principles develop from one to another, and then he might obviously he has to go back once you tell him, and he has to figure, oh, you're right. Or he could say, well, you applied my principle wrong. I don't know. That's a separate question, but either way, so that's a dispute between what we call Rashi versus the Rambam. So we know we have a discussion. The Kesef Mishnah writes in Hilchot Mamrim and others. We have a tradition that Amoraim don't argue on Tanaim. That the rabbis of the Talmud do not disagree with the rabbis of the Mishnah. Apparently, because we believe in Judaism, the closer you are to Sinai, the closer you are to the Mesorah, the stronger it is. The further you go down the link of chains, you know, the more chance for mistake or error or not as clear. So that's why. So it's assumed as a. So the question is Amoraim not allowed to argue on Tanaim, or can they? But they're just smart not to, because it's not a good idea to argue on people who know more than you. So the Torah Tamima.
Yes, I've heard a Rebbe soon, Rebbe saying, arguing with a Tanaim, it's not that it's wrong. It's just that it's stupid.
Right, so I'll give you one person who says it's wrong, and I'll give you one guy who says it's stupid.
Yeah, okay.
So the Torah Tamima's opinion is Amoram aren't allowed to argue on Tanakh, which is going to be a difficult sheet, because we find in the Gemara they do, and we pass them like the Amoram. But either way, his sheet is like this. He says, the Torah Tamima, he brings this down on Parashat Lech Lecha. It's really based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, but it talks about Avraham Avinu, Anefesh Yeshar Asu Becharon, when Avraham came to convert the men, teach them ethical monotheism, and started the women. So the Pasuk Anefesh Yeshar Asu Becharon, so he quotes from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, we have a tradition that the Mashiach's not going to come for 6,000 years. The first 2,000 years are going to be years of Tohu Vavohu, this void, emptiness. From 2,000 to 4,000 are the era of Torah. And from 4,000 to 6,000 is the era of the Mashiach. So apparently Rabbi Akiva, the one who was giving shir, did not have this tradition. Why do we say apparently he didn't have it? Because Rabbi Akiva was one of the proponents of Bar Kokhba. Bar Kaziva, he thought he was originally anyway, he thought he was going to be the Melech HaMashiach. In fact, that's why one of the from archaeologists today, there's a whole discussion. I don't know so much on the topic, but they were checking down, doing work, maybe making sure that the things stay up. They saw, you know, different things down there, and they're trying, and different historians throughout the years have tried to figure out. They can't figure out because it doesn't meet the dimensions of Bayis Rishon, the first temple, or the second temple. And they all come up with different reasons why it's either. So there's this one who lives in Muncie. He's a firm guy. I think his name is Resnick. He came up based on the psukim. He said it's the Bayis Shlishi. He said, so the pshat, we never had a third temple. So he comes up with the pshat, you know, again, it's projection, but you know, just as good as anyone else's, that he says what happened was when Bar Kokhba, and they thought he was the Mashiach, they were living in Yerushalayim for many years. Obviously, during that time, they didn't have the same modern technology. It takes a long time with all. So he says they actually started building. They actually started making plans to build the third Beis HaMikdash, and that's what when you see whichever part they're talking about exactly, I don't know. But he said that was his interesting suggestion. It fits in with dimensions. Fit in to the Bayis Shlishi. That's why no one considered a Bayis Shlishi because we don't have it. But he said it could be when they had Yerushalayim. What do? You have a Melech HaMashiach. You have Bar Kokhba, I think he had coins in his name, so he claimed maybe they started building the third temple. So originally, Rabbi Akiva thought he was the guy, until I think they say that one time he heard him say, when he was fighting the war, he says, God, you don't have to help me, just don't get in my way, just don't be on the other side, something along those lines. And when Rabbi Akiva heard that, he said, this guy can't be the Mashiach. And that's why they say it's interesting, they say he snuck out that night. That's why there's a story in the Talmud where Rabbi Akiva is walking alone. All he has is a little lamp. And the question, like one of the Gedolei Hador walking alone, where's all his students? Where's everyone? So they say he couldn't have made it public or else Bar Kokhba would have killed him. And therefore, one night he snuck out just by himself one night. That's why he explains he was wandering around by himself. So what happened was Rabbi Akiva, and Rambam said he didn't do anything wrong, Rabbi Akiva. In other words, you could be Becheskes, the Rambam writes, that if people would learn the last two chapters of Hilchus Malachim in the Rambam, then a lot of terrible tragedies in Jewish history could have, like the Shabbosai Tzvi disaster, because a lot, in other words, the Rambam...
Who are you quoting? Is this your own opinion that people should have
read? Yeah, I'm just saying what everyone says. It's black and white in the Rambam. What a Mashiach can't be. That's all I'm saying. Is,
I see.
Right, so, but so one of the things he writes is that, I'm not sure you might even put Rabbi Akiva down there when he writes it, but he says something that, whether he uses Rabbi Akiva or not, but we could use him, he says, a person who Rambam has a very bottom line approach, result oriented. There's certain things that have to lead up. He can be Becheskes Mashiach. A person has a chazaka, and there's nothing wrong with believing him. It's okay. He fits into, as I say, I would have been happy. The Labachari was the Mashiach, great. But now he's dead, and I don't see any peace around, so therefore that conclude me that he's not. But the same thing with Rabbi Akiva. It wasn't that Bar Kokhba couldn't have been it. It wasn't that he was wrong at the time. Maybe Bar Kokhba never made it, but as the stages were, it's not overnight you decide if he's the Mashiach. There's certain stages you follow. Bar Kokhba seemed to be one of the possibilities. And, and obviously when he saw what didn't happen, he knew, you know, he realized it wasn't him. But it wasn't like it was a mistake per se that it couldn't have been him. Maybe it could have been him. So the, but he, yeah.
So I don't understand. You're saying that according to the Rambam, if Rabbi Akiva had read the Rambam's last two chapters, it still would have
no, been. No, I'm saying Rabbi Akiva would have been fine when Rabbi Akiva didn't make any mistake. What I'm saying is Rabbi Akiva is fine. He followed, Rabbi Akiva knew. I'm talking about later on. Rabbi Akiva knew the rules. What I'm saying is Rabbi Akiva wasn't wrong per se.
Okay.
It's easy in retrospect. We know he wasn't. But at the time, you have to follow. So he followed signs that he was allowed to. And then he realized once he saw that's what the Rabbam's lashon. A person could be becheskes Mashiach. He appears to be it, but then if he doesn't get to the bottom line, you know, whatever the bottom line is, peace, rebuilding the temple, whatever the bottom line is, and then you know he's not it. By Rabbam, it's clear. If he doesn't do his job, you know he's not it. It doesn't mean you were wrong for following him, but then when you see he didn't do the job, you know he's not it. So Rabbi Akiva apparently, or maybe held anyway, you could bring the Mashiach early, but either way, what I'm saying, what they say is he apparently didn't have the tradition because Bar Kokhba lived before the year 4000 and he thought he was Mashiach. It's not really a kasha anyway, but that's what they point out. Mm-hmm. So Rabbi Akiva lived 70 years after Churban Bayis Sheni, after the destruction of the Second Temple. And so therefore people said, you know, Mashiach can't come before the year 4000. So they said to him, grass is going to grow on your forehead long before the Mashiach is going to come. In other words, you're going to be dead, buried under the ground for a long time before the Mashiach is going to come. So, and in fact, and there's another allusion to this tradition. The Rokeach writes on the first Pasuk in Chumash, Bereshis Bara Elokim, he says in Pasuk Aleph in Genesis, it has the letter Aleph six times, referring to the 6,000 years. That it's an allusion that the world's going to be here for 6,000 years before the Mashiach comes. But either way, Avram was born in the year 1948, Jewish year, 1948. And at 52 was the year 2000, the Y2K. What happened in Y2K in the Jewish year? That's HaNefesh, that's when Avram started spreading Torah, ethical monotheism. The first 2,000 years were Tohu Vavohu. From the next 2,000 years, Avram started spreading Torah. No, not just Avram and everyone after him. So the Torah Tumim writes, and historically it's true as well, that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the one who wrote up the Mishnayos, he died about the equivalent close to the year 4000 in the Jewish year. I think it was about year 220 to year 240, but approximately during that time period of the year 4000, the Jewish year. So that's what he claims, that's the Torah Tumim claim. And the reason why rabbis in the Talmud can't argue with rabbis in the Mishnah because that's the cutoff point. In other words, that's what it means. What's the significance of the Gemara when it says 4,000 is the end of Torah? It means is the rabbis of the Gemara cannot argue with the rabbis. That's the source, he claims, that the rabbis of the Talmud can't argue with the rabbis because that was the end of Torah. That was the cutoff point. After the year 4,000, Amoraim can't argue with Tanam. The rabbis of the Talmud can't argue with the rabbis in the Mishnah. That's what the Torah Tamima claims. However, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Achanan Wasserman, they say it's not true. If you open up the Gemara Ksuvis and many other Gemaras, it says Rav Tani Vapolig. It says Rav, the Amora Rav, who was the Rav in the Gemara, he argued with Tanaim. And not only did he argue with rabbis in the Mishnah, we even follow the opinion of Rav over the opinion. So clearly, it's not true. Obviously, we find Amoraim in the Gemara arguing, so clearly it wasn't done all the time and it wasn't a common practice, but the Torah Tumim principle can't be true. In other words, he's giving a principle you're not allowed to. Not that you're a fool, but it's you're wrong to. According to Rav Chaim, Rav Ochanan, you see clearly that Rav did it and we follow Rav. So therefore you have to come up with a new explanation. What's the significance of the year 4000? In other words, clearly it can't be the cutoff point between rabbis in the Gemara and rabbis in the Mishnah, because we find rabbis in the Gemara do argue with rabbis in the Mishnah. So what is it? So the Chazon Ish wants to take a shot at it. The Chazon Ish, not even on this topic, but in Hilchos Treifos, there's a halacha of treif. Again, we call treif non-kosher, but treif halachically means an animal which has an internal hole in the organ, in the lung, wherever, and to die within 12 months. That's considered a trefa. So the question is, today, when today in our day and age, there are some animals that the Gemara labels a treifa that today we see live much more than 12 months. And conversely, you have animals which the Gemara says are in a treifa, different things that happen to them that don't make them into a treifa, yet today they die within 12 months. So what do we do? What's the definition of a treifa? In other words, do we go by what it's now? Do we go by what it's then? How do we know what to do? So the Chazon Ish wants to claim as follows, that the significance of the year 4000, the cutoff point is, that's the end of new concepts. And when Chazal are defining terms, be it a treifa, the definition of a treifa is, whatever in the year 4000, when Chazal got together and they said, this is a treifa, it's irrelevant, the halachic reality is what counts. What's going to happen later on, you know, so if we were around later on, maybe we'd change it, but we're not. So the year 4000 was the cutoff point, so even though we might see an animal living more than 12 months, but according to the Chazon Ish, obviously it's a whole complex discussion, but the bottom line of the Chazon Ish is that it doesn't matter what's happening now, we go back to the cutoff point was the year 4000, whatever the Chazal determined the definition of a treifa, that's a treifa now. Or they discuss, let's say, by Kriya Shema. There's a whole discussion that, you know, it says in the Torah, B'shav Pekov Kumecha. You say Kriya Shema when you're going to sleep and when you're getting up in the morning. So we know we only have until like 3 hours into the day, because that's when the king, those are the latest people to get up are the kings. So people ask, like, what do you mean? So today people sleep much later. So maybe we shouldn't be able to say Kriya Shema to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I know people sleep the whole day. So again, so there's many different answers how you learn Kumecha, but some say it goes by the definition during the time, you know, during that time period when Chazal defined what does Vekumecha mean. So they were the cutoff point. Or let's say, another example is, we know we can't do Malacha on Shabbos. You know, it's pretty clear in the Torah, Lo Sasako Malacha. We can't do creative activity on Shabbos. And it's pretty clear also about Yontif. Yontif's a little different, you can do Ochol Nefesh. The Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days, is very vague. There's not much discussion in the Torah about not doing malacha on Chol HaMoed. So much so that it's a machlokas rishonim whether doing malacha on Chol HaMoed is a biblical prohibition or a rabbinical prohibition. It centers around a very interesting phrase in the Talmud. The Talmud says something along these lines. It says, Lo Masu HaKasuv Ela l'chachamim. The Torah gave it over to the Chachamim. So some say it means I'm doing malacha and Chol HaMoed is the Rabbanan. They give it over to Chachamim. But others say, no, that's not the pshat. Doing malacha and Chol HaMoed is biblical. What it means to say is, what's the definition of malacha and Chol HaMoed? How do I know what, in this like we know what the certain definition on Shabbos, what you can, the cans and the can, and the do's and the don'ts. On Yontif, you have the do's and the don'ts. On Chol HaMoed, the year 4000, that's the cutoff. We can't make a new definition today what's considered malacha on Chol HaMoed. The definition of the no new concepts after the, as you could argue on the details of it, etc. But in terms of making up new definitions today, what's the definition of Chol HaMoed? That was the cutoff point is the year 4000. So what's the definition of a treifa? What's the definition of a malacha? Those are all, that's what the Chazon Ish claims. That was the cutoff point. On the year 4000. It's not that Amoram can argue on Tonam, nothing to do with that. But it means that we can't create new concepts anymore. We could obviously argue, you find many machokism after, that's on details of it. Like for instance, the Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat, Simen Chaf Hei, the Rama writes, you can argue on earlier scholars. He basically says, I can argue on people who came before me, people who came after me could argue on me. He says, but what can't you do? I think he writes, Amoram could argue on Tanaim, that Achronim could argue on Rishonim. What can't you do? What's the cutoff point? He says, everyone who lived before the Gemara says in Bava Metzia, Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora. Ravina Ravashi closed up shop on the Gemara. They were the last rabbis in the time.
Was Rabbeinu.
What?
It was Rabbeinu. What's his name?
No, Rabbeinu Yehuda HaNasi. Yes. He's the Mishnah.
Oh, that's not the cutoff. Some say
right.
It's not the
Mishnah. Right, that was Torah Tamim, and I was saying...
We got a new cutoff.
Yeah, because that's not true, because we see Amor Ram arguing...
So we've shifted the cutoff later.
Right, so... Yeah, because... Okay. So he's saying, so the Rama says that what's the cutoff point? Everyone who lived up until the time of Ravina Ravashi could argue with Amoram, could argue on Tanam, on Gaon, and anyone who came before that, it's free reign. You could interpret the Pesukim the way you see fit. Anyone who comes after the Gemara was codified, you could argue on anyone after that, but you can't today. Anyway, I could again. This is, I could say the Rambam is wrong. It might be pretty stupid of me to say that since he knows a lot more than me. But in theory, I could fundamentally argue on a Rishon today. The Vilna Gaon did it all the time. But if I say I can't say the Gemara is wrong, that's not because in other words, I can't argue. As Solanter said today, the Gemara, so to speak, almost has the status of Torah Shebiktav. In other words, we can't. The Gemara now, Gemara is a given now. We don't have a right. We could, you know, how you interpret the Gemara is something else. But we can't. I can't say whether the Gemara made a mistake. Okay, this is the pshat. I could say Rambam made a mistake. Again, it's not too wise unless I have a lot of proof to it. But he's saying the cutoff point of Rambam writes is the Chachme HaGemara. When the Gemara was codified, that's it. The Gemara is a given now. Like in geometry, you have givens. Yeah, Kim?
Sorry, you've got us spinning on some questions here.
Okay.
So look, this is the Torah
Tamima.
Who you quoted?
No, now it's not. We finished
it.
So we rejected the Torah Tamima.
I beg your pardon. Who's this person?
I'm quoting the Vilna. I'm quoting the Rama. What I'm saying was, you know, it's not a Chiddush.
You're saying it's a lighter thing. It's not the Mishnah, but the Gemara.
Right. The Rama and the Vilna Gaon write it. But the Gemara says Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora. So what does that mean?
Okay.
So the classical Torah means that's the end of Psach. Mm-hmm. You can't be cholik on the Gemara anymore.
Yes,
on the actual on what they mean. So obviously it's wide open. Okay. But I'm saying our job is to understand, you know, what they mean. We can't say they're wrong.
There's an interesting question here because I think every religion goes through a development like this. And if you even look at the development of post-Judaism, but developments after Judaism, when you have Christianity and Muslim,
right?
They added to what was there.
Yes.
And then they said, "This is the last. This is it. This closes up shop." And Muhammad did the same thing, right? He says, "I'm last and greatest prophet." And he closes shop there.
Right. So the sheikh is also no one can be cholak on Muhammad now.
Right.
So, or whatever. Whoever can go on. Right.
So now this the questions seem to be authority. The intriguing part of this is, as soon as you canonize, at some point. Like you're talking now, not only canonization of Chumash and Tanakh, and then you go in Mishnah and Gemara get canonized, right? And they get closed up. The question always comes up, who's the dude at the end who closes up shop? Because do they themselves say, you know, obviously when they're dead and gone, they don't say, and by the way, I'm the last and greatest, now don't try and do a thing with this after I'm gone. I mean, that kind of, if they say that, that detracts from their credibility entirely, doesn't it?
That's in terms of, so I say the difference between. So in the 24 books of Tanakh, it is canonized, but obviously that had to do with, that obviously had to play, Nevuah played a role, prophecy played a role in terms of when you closed up shop. Here's a different type of closing. It's not in other words, a pi halacha, in principle, the Gemara is not the same way as the Chumash. This is a pragmatic closed up shop. In other words, when the Gemara, what we're going to have to get into is the Gemara even tells us, Rabbi Huda Hanasi, he was very reluctant to put the Mishnah into print, and obviously also the people in the Gemara. In other words, the Torah Shabbat Peh, the goal was it remained oral all the time. There's a big reluctancy to put it into print, so we have to have to get into why were they reluctant, and that will touch on your point here.
Oh, really?
Why were they reluctant to put it into print? And one reason is that once they put it into print, it loses its flexibility. So when it's oral, so then you could go back and forth. It's still dynamic, but not the same way. So now we lose some flexibility. Like we say, we can't argue on the Gemara anymore. In other words, some affirmation point out the reason why they had a close up shop is because the concern was because it's the oral. It was so open that the danger is the wrong people getting involved in the tradition and poisoning the tradition. So they felt at that point, whoever it was, the Chachamim during that time, saw what was happening, whether the secular, whatever the influences were, the danger was incorporating non-Torah sources into the tradition. That's another explanation why they closed up shop. The concern was, that like anything, it's a double-edged sword. There's a bracha and a kola to it. That ultimately, the idea would be to leave it wide open, even today. But the danger of leaving it wide open is become distorted, and you have nothing. So they have better to keep what you have in, which is fluid and working, and then you close up. But you know, it was clearly a reluctance. He didn't want, and there was no one said it was a great thing to do. It was a situation. The goal was the Jews would have forgot the Torah. If he didn't put it down into print, then the Torah would have been forgotten. So it was the lesser of the two evils.
When you talk about time getting away from Sinai, in science, it's the exact opposite. You would consider in science that the more time that elapses, the more encyclopedic our total knowledge.
Exactly,
we should be getting better. We should be getting closer to the truth.
No, that's what I'm saying. The opposite in Torah, because like I said, the closer we move away from Sinai, so therefore the further we move away from the tradition.
But is that a solid assumption? I'm asking.
Science.
I mean with Torah though.
Oh no.
I mean, don't we have more sources to compare now? Like, you have far more books than Moses had, so come on. You can do far more
research.
Look at
the odd scrolls, right?
He didn't have
odd scroll history of the Gedolim. What did he know?
Right, exactly. Maybe if it's just based on Chachma, it's a good point, because you take this person's wisdom and that wisdom, but it's based on Nevuah, so it's not an argument. In other words, if we hold Moshe Rabbeinu is the Av and Nevi'im, the father of, and no one could ever know it better, so that if you don't have that premise, you're right, so then I would argue, it's just saying, every future generation should know better. That's why that's the difference in Orthodox Judaism. It's not true because that's what Rambam said about Aristotle. In terms of wisdom, he was the smartest guy ever. It's why, but all he had was Chachma. We have Nevuah. That's the reason why we know better. But if it's just an argument based on Chachma, I agree with you 100%. It's built on this Chachma and that Chachma. You're right. But if it's based on a Nevuah, then the argument doesn't go the whole way.
Masorah, yes. Yeah. Look, with the two stages of writing down the oral thing. One is with the Mishnah, other with the Gemara. Each stage, I mean, there's a separate process here. One is they made the Mishnah from spoken to written, and then later on they made the Gemara.
That's what I'm going to get. That's my next point we'll have to continue on. Why is the Gemara the cutoff point? Yeah. I'm going to touch on that point.
So maybe possibly next Sunday? If
sounds good. Next Sunday, part two.
Coming up.